I just panicked. So I'm just spinning all over the kitchen in the dark. This is The Job, a talk show about design, music, business, culture, and Portland. I'm your host, Ray Briglib. Our guest on episode 18 is Taisha Snow. But first, let's talk to Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Ray.
18.
Yeah, 18.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, our podcast can smoke.
I was trying to think of what big milestone happens at 18.
Our podcast has been driving for several episodes and can't drink for a few more, so...
Some states, right?
I don't know.
Canada, 19?
I don't know Canada.
Well, when you're a teenager and you grow up around the border...
That's right.
You know.
It's like how I knew Wisconsin growing up in Minnesota. It was like... Where you went to get the beer that had the actual alcohol.
Yeah. I went to college in Bellingham, so, you know, 19 was it 20? I can't even remember now. I do recall driving up to Canada just so that I could go to a bar and have a beer.
Yeah. So here's what I wanted to talk about.
Sure.
And this is how I'm starting, and it's going to sound nerdy, and I don't care. But I this is the time of year when I make the horrible mistake of... immediately installing the new OS on my phone, which totally ruins...
it's pretty, though.
It's pretty.
That's nice.
But my phone does not work. My daughter learned to walk, basically, yesterday, and I could not get my damn phone to video. It, like, would crash and reboot and stuff, and I'm just like, give me a camera. I just had to grab an old school camera. Because
that's why there are so many photos on my phone. This morning I was going through and I kept thinking, I don't remember taking
the
photo.
Oh, yeah, I had to grab your phone and taking the photos. Yeah.
You know, there's something a little bit sad about that because I actually thought that I'd improved as a photographer.
Oh.
Wow, I'm doing really well. I don't remember these, but...
I think... So I've really, really, really been enjoying the complete redesign of the OS. I'm surprised that Apple did it. And I feel like there's been like a pileup of criticism on them for it. But, you know, judging by how much my phone is crashing, I'd say this was kind of rushed. It's a huge project. As Frank Camaro wrote, it's like they... From what we've heard, they got this far in 7 months. They don't even for the first time in years, there isn't even an iPad version yet in the beta period. Like, it's not even, they barely got it working on a phone at this point. And like, for as someone who's a partner in a design agency, I can tell you 7 months to do something of that scope would be ridiculous. No matter how many people you had working for you, it would be a huge undertaking because there's so it's incredible the amount of detail in those interfaces and how many things they had to think through. Why are you smiling?
Did it make you want a white iPhone?
Yeah, it does. It totally does.
That's the first thing I thought when I saw that. I was like, I'm so glad my phone's white.
Yeah, the interface is designed for a white device.
Rather than. Do you think they'll even make the black iPhones once this comes out?
Yeah, sure.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, a couple of the apps have pure black backgrounds. Like, there's definitely, you know, but yeah, it does. It is a much lighter. It's a nice interface. And from what I've seen, someone hacked it and got it working on an iPad and took screenshots. Like, Apple haven't even shown a screenshot. And even there, I saw some interesting ideas. Anyway, I wanted to say that I think that what Apple did is awesome and that I think that way about projects when we're doing websites.
That they're awesome.
Well, that they're awesome. But more specifically in this case, that this is kind of like a first round mock-up from Apple. Like, there's 3 more months before this thing comes out.
Before, okay.
Yeah. Months. Like, so I would say where they're at right now is like, you know, 70% done maybe.
Right.
And, you know, that aside, I would say that, like, a lot of times when we show our first round of mock-ups to the client, like Apple at this stage in their public betas, it's like you want to show the most radical thing possible. You want to really push the boundaries, because you're never going to get to such a crazy place again. As you iterate and you get more of the client's feedback and develop the idea, it tends to get tamer.
Right.
And that's what's going to happen with the OS. Like, the things that I see people complaining about now are probably a lot of the things that our clients would say when we show them a first mock-up. And they're totally reasonable and understandable concerns, like, I can't use this, it's confusing, it's way too different, And that's fine, because, Apple's building a phone not for themselves, but for us, just like we build a website for a client. So as you iterate on that, those kinks get smoothed out. And I feel like it's really weird for people to be critiquing the interface in such detail when it's obviously going to change dramatically over the next few months, and it's going to get more usable, and it's probably going to look a little bit less dramatic,
Mm-hmm.
Like, in 3 months, when you update your phone and get the new OS, it's probably going to make sense. It's going to be like, okay, I think they worked out all the kinks. They got the icons don't look so crazy sauce,
You know, when I was looking at your version, though, it made sense. They just weren't the ones we were used to. It seemed intuitive. Like, if that was the first phone you were handed, it seemed intuitive. It just might not seem intuitive to somebody who's gotten used to the phone in a different way. It's like they actually were able to just kind of throw some of that out and say, what would I make now?
I think so. And I think that what they did, a lot of that was getting rid of the weird sort of, tactile metaphors of, the calendar with the leather stitching and all that stuff,
I'm not a fan of those. Like, you know what? It's a phone. There's no leather.
Yeah. But if you look at the calendar app, for instance, it's the way it works is very different too.
Mm-hmm. And like I do think it's flipping pages.
Yeah, it doesn't have any of that. It's way more logical. Like, you are kind of zooming in and out. You zoom out, you see the year. You zoom in, you see the week. Then you zoom in and you see the day.
I'm not waiting 3 months. This sounds amazing.
Well, you can install the beta, but now we've bought two phones.
Except that you can't make phone calls or take photos.
Actually, the phone calls I haven't had a problem with. It's the apps are all going to need to be rewritten, and there's going to be a lot of frustrated developers out there because mm-hmm. it's such a big transition. But Apple is not afraid to do this, and I'm really glad to see them in this post-Steve Jobs era doing that. Like, there was a time when Apple suddenly came out on stage and said, oh, yeah, in a few months, we're going to have this running on Intel processors. Like, change the complete architecture.
Yeah.
And all the developers had to, rewrite their apps, and did fairly quickly. But, that's kind of what kept Apple ahead of the curve, was just saying, we're just going for it.
Do you think that people that decide to be Apple developers just factor that into their process? The idea that something can be thrown at them at any time and they'll have to rewrite everything?
Well, I'd say three things. One, everybody, the rumors about this update have been coming for 7 months. I think everyone mm-hmm. kind of knew that when the guy who was in charge of iOS was fired and Johnny Ive was kind of put in charge, that this would happen. Two, they do these updates annually on a fixed schedule now. So everyone knows that if there's changes, watch for them come, June. They'll be announced. You have 3 months before other people will have it on their phones. So that's a good window of time to make those changes. And three, I feel like the phone is expected to move a lot quicker than like the Mac desktop interface
mm-hmm.
because it's still pretty young.
Is there a new phone coming out?
Yeah, there will be this fall when the new OS formally comes out. I'm sure there'll be a 5S or something, There always is. The phones are on a schedule too,
Because I broke the case to my phone.
Again?
Well, it's chipped.
Oh. No, I think it'll be the same form factor, so you can keep that case.
Okay.
That's not a reason
for needing a new phone.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our guest today is Taisha Snow. Our conversation, fascinating as always, touched a lot on thinking through user interface design. She just got through talking to the Nike Tech Stars, mentoring a bunch of the Tech Stars people on making what often are iOS apps to use the Nike Fuel system and a bunch of other stuff. So fascinating conversation. Let's hear from Taisha. Hello, Taisha.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm pretty good. I went this morning and tried to watch my daughter in swim class because I've been missing it every time, and she couldn't do it with me there. She just cried, so I had to like sit outside. but it was still cute.
How is that going? Is that like when Zoe was in swim class, she would throw up like every time.
Oh no. No. Ellington loves it. Okay. She jumps off the side of the pool now and everything. It's okay. Pretty cool. Well, so, I don't know.
Then we did the right thing, taking her out of it. It was it was harrowing.
Aww.
It would always be like, okay, we'll put her in the car seat. And we put her in the car seat and then blah.
Oh, sad.
Right in the car seat. Like that car seat was like just pale from being washed so many times.
I'm good. I'm good.
Okay.
Yesterday with a big job, so that was fun.
So why don't you tell me about that? That's a great place to start.
Okay, yeah. I've been working as sort of an on-site in-house designer / mentor at the Nike Plus TechStars Accelerator.
Okay.
And that was 10 teams for 3 months working on various products. Some of the people came in with just an idea. Some people had products already in the market, and and they came to accelerate their business. And
is that like local people or people from?
It was a global search, and most of the companies were from the U.S. One from Hong Kong, one from Canada. So, and then across the country. So.
And are these people making products specific to like work with Nike stuff?
So they were provided access to the Nike Plus and Nike Fuel API. So these are the first companies to get access to it, and Nike just completed it like the day that everyone arrived. So
so
pretty cool opportunity to see how they might leverage that data and sort of the.
Okay, so they could be making like. Just theoretically, they could be making an iPhone app that used that data.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. Absolutely.
Okay.
So there's everything from like a tool for employees in a workplace to like track and compete and get more healthy together to a game that's you build a fighting robot with your fuel and then fight it with your fuel. Right.
That's a cool idea.
I know. That's a fun one. I mean, just this whole idea of if you're going to be quantifying yourself, like what do you do with that? With that data or that information.
Yeah.
And, you know, right now there's not a lot to do with it. So, you know, a piece of the idea of the program was, you know, let's put it out there and see what ideas people have to utilize this, you know, new currency that Nike's developed called Fuel. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool. How did you get involved in something like that? Maybe we should backtrack.
Sure.
How did you... Where are you from?
I am from, well, I like to say my formative years were in Mill City, Oregon, which is east of Salem, a town of 1,500 people. Mm. So up in the mountains and then just hanging out with my friends and running around. Uh-huh. And then I went to high school in Salem. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so a Northwesterner.
So it seems like you do a lot with... I mean, do you do other work with kind of startups or that sort of thing?
Well, you know, right now I am doing primarily early stage companies.
Okay.
Which is awesome. Uh-huh. So I've done everything from work in-house before at on products, and then most of my career has been in agency. So this is kind of a nice shift for me, and it's really kind of... There's so much excitement right now around building new products and sort of an innovation. It's nice to be part of that.
It seems like it's happening a lot in Portland.
Yeah, right.
Lately. Yeah, definitely. So it seems like your skills are varied. Where did all of this come from? Is it just like hands-on experience or like formal education or
Yeah, good question. I would love to do a film someday about the stories of user experience designers and experienced designers and how they got there, because we all have, you know, really varied stories that tend to be zigzagged and multifaceted. But for me, I went to school for political ecology and art.
Okay.
And political ecology works in sort of a systems theory perspective and really a research-driven discipline. And so that's kind of the realm I came from, always a bit interested in design and art. But I don't have a formal design background, more coming from just an informed thinking background.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of with that interest in natural abilities, I just kind of started performing tasks in the jobs I was in that led to this, and then being trained on the job at classmates.com was sort of the first time I officially held the role. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So what does, what is it about Portland that seems to be making startup and early stage ventures and these kinds of things so commonplace now? I mean, not commonplace, but it's like there's the Nike thing that you referenced. There's the Portland incubator, mm-hmm. and I'm spacing out the names now, but it seems like there's others.
Yeah.
What do you think is causing all of that? Is that happening everywhere, or is Portland just at this nice?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of new to it myself in a way. You know, just chose to participate in the incubator because I wanted to learn, or the accelerator. I guess there's a difference there. There's a difference there. Because I wanted to learn more. But I guess here's one theory. Some of the agencies that are in town that have been, you know, growing really amazing creatives, and then those folks are looking for additional things to do and start building small agencies, and then more people start getting inspired, and they're looking for some place to apply that, you know, beyond traditional agency style work. I don't know, I mean, that could be one sense, but that doesn't explain sort of the technology end of that. Although right now, I mean, so many products don't even have anything new related to technology. It's more about figuring out interesting ways to leverage stuff that already exists. So
true.
I think that fits pretty nicely with the type of creative minds that we have in this town.
Mm-hmm.
But it's speculation. I don't know. Maybe it's just the environment, the entrepreneurial spirit of just wanting to work for yourself, sit in a cafe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Go to the mountain whenever you want. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. How do you approach thinking about user experience yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Especially working with like that program, the accelerators program. Is it kind of more like you just sit down and play around with the product and just give some feedback, some bullet points, or are you thinking it through from the start?
All of that, maybe.
Okay.
I mean, I think of my job as making things make sense, right? And that can happen in a lot of different ways. One could be just, you know, fixing something that's literally confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Another could be that there's an idea for a product offering and need to figure out how that makes sense for people's lives and how to craft it and position it in a way that people accept it and want it and need it. So there's that piece of it. So I spend a lot of time in my work, and I think this is true even with when I work in marketing and advertising too, is, you know, sitting down with people who have some thoughts about where they want to go with something and helping them make sense of their own thoughts and ideas, and then contributing a little bit of, you know-how or knowledge to that, either just based on my own experience or research that I do for the product.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times I sit with people and we you know, I listen to them, we go through all of the information, go away for a while, do some research of various types, and then mm-hmm. come back and say, hey, is this what you were thinking? Mm-hmm. And just that act of sort of representing it, repositioning it in a way that starts to make sense either for the business, for the people, the consumers. Mm-hmm. So there's that exercise. Mm-hmm. And then there's everything just down to, taking a look at a current product and seeing how we might craft it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I really like the information architecture piece. And sometimes I think, especially with product design, that's the one little piece that sometimes gets overlooked. And if the bones of a product don't make sense, mm-hmm. or you present them in a way that's kind of presenting the architecture incorrectly, people... Mm-hmm. People don't know, they couldn't point their finger at why it feels funny to them, but they can sense it, and then it starts to sort of crumble their understanding of how they should integrate it in their life, mm-hmm. what they're supposed to know, what they're supposed to do with it. Okay. I don't know, that's kind of abstract.
I guess,
it's super abstract.
Which is fine. I guess I'm more curious, like, building on that, is it more like... Is it for you more of like a mental sort of abstract exercise, or do you sometimes just sit down and like use like paper prototypes or those kinds of tools? Like, do you have a favorite tool for just sort of like iterating or digging deeper into a problem like that?
Yeah. Well, I use spreadsheets a lot.
Okay.
Which is
interesting.
Yeah. I love to dump a bunch of just content down on there and then just move it around, you know, and then start to organize it in that sense. And I don't know, I'm the only one I know who does it that way, mm-hmm. but I like that. I am not a huge paper and pen fan so much, just because I liked my mind's moving so quickly, mm-hmm. that I find just sketching an omnigraphal and moving things, I can move around and duplicate and try it again and erase it and move it in. You know, I do exercise that's more similar to sketching, but I just do it digitally. It just is faster for me.
That makes sense. The ability to move things on paper would...
Exactly.
Could be cumbersome.
And like duplicate it and try a little alteration and a little alteration. So I know there's a lot of paper and pen talk these days, but I don't know. Yeah. What do you use?
It's all the rage. Well, honestly, I don't think we do enough of what you're describing. But in general, I would say, we just sketch.
On paper.
And it usually is very iterative. And I often force myself to just use a Sharpie so I don't waste a lot of time. Because sometimes at some point I was like, I love sketching. I'm going to get a stencil set and a drafting kit.
Oh, yeah,
and I was
like,
okay, that's ridiculous. I just spent a whole day sketching out something that I could have done in 20 minutes in Illustrator or OmniGraphle or something. So
yeah,
I hid that so I wouldn't use it.
Well, I'm a big fan of I guess you do it both ways. I'm a big fan of like being able to step back and see where I came from on a thought or an idea.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you toss something and actually maybe it was a good thing.
I guess a lot of times we'll do, and this is probably particular to websites, but I guess it is just use like 3x5 index cards.
I love the 3x5.
And a lot of times I'll just sort of stack them to figure out how to tell a story
as
a page progresses, or spread them out to kind of start thinking about what content we have and how to organize it.
Yeah.
So I guess that... I should have said that's my first answer.
Yeah, right. Little mini card sorts on your...
Yeah, and then I'll just take a photo of it and put it right in the fold in the project. And
I am kind of anti-whiteboard right now, though. And particularly, I saw this a lot down at the accelerator, was as long as something's on a whiteboard and can be quickly erased, it's not really down. It's not really on paper, and so people... don't record it.
Yeah.
So it can just like go away so quick. And so some really great ideas just can like disappear in a second.
It's true.
The other is people don't feel committed to it if it's not like written down and they can't seem to sort of go beyond it.
Yeah.
So if you get it off that freaking whiteboard, and, like sketch it out in OmniGraphle or whatever your program is, or even on paper, then all of a sudden it becomes a little bit more real and people mm-hmm. can sort of, especially if you're working in a team environment, everyone can start working on their own little piece of it. But as long as it's something that can just disappear with the, you know, wipe of the hand and, I don't know.
Yeah, the closest we've gotten is, sometimes I write on the window, but
yeah,
I don't want to put up an actual whiteboard because something psychologically about a whiteboard that I don't like.
Yeah, you don't like it either.
Yeah, it's just when I see a whiteboard,
is it too businessy?
I feel like I gotta like put on my suit and tie to use a whiteboard, and it just seems like just sketching on paper on a table with a couple of people around is nice. Or like just if you work on your computer and you're in a group, you can always take turns putting something on AirPlay and just looking at it on the screen. It seems also useful. But
I've seen some weird power play stuff go on with the whiteboard too, right?
Yes, I've heard stories, famous stories of like, you know, Steve Jobs like firing someone because they erased something on his whiteboard or something.
Oh,
like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that goes on all the time, like power plays over whiteboards. Like, this is my whiteboard. Bring your own whiteboard.
I know. Huh.
Everyone has their own tripod with a whiteboard at the meeting.
Yeah, there's like something about just like whoever makes it to the whiteboard first is controlling the meeting. And I was like, yeah.
Right. And then on the other hand, like when we were talking about paper prototypes, I think the book was like Bill Buxton, is that the guy's name, who wrote a book about sketching? But it's like he has photos throughout this elaborate book of doing like paper prototyping, where it's like he'll simulate like a user interface by like stacking notes and like cutting out holes so you can slide things. And it's just ridiculous. It's like, couldn't you do that more easily just on an iPad or you know,
yeah. Well, I guess whatever's going to keep you happy in your job, so whatever,
you know,
feels good.
Yeah.
And keeps your brain moving.
People are so hands-on that maybe that's the only way that they can really think through a problem.
Absolutely. That's what I think. I mean, you gotta figure out, like, how to do this work in a way that keeps you happy.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
One of your talents, I think this came from your website. I'm not sure. This was a question from the audience. But one of your talents was developing strong and trusted relationships with clients. I'm curious what advice you'd give other creatives on developing that skill, developing those relationships.
Okay.
That's a big question right there.
Yeah. I mean, I can kind of wrap it back to a little bit of what we've already talked about, and mirroring back what people say, which is a form of listening, right? So
sure.
I think you can't really sort of move further and move in unique, interesting directions and start to take your client, you know, in the direction you'd like to, you know, without first sort of acknowledging where they're at and trying to understand where they're coming from. So for me, I think when I'm done with a presentation and people are like, oh my goodness, you actually heard us. We've been trying, and you figured out how to do something with what we've been thinking about. Like, that's the best moment right there.
Sure.
So you never want to sort of walk away from a meeting feeling like you just blindsided them or that they weren't part of the journey to get there. They want to, you know, help. It is their business.
Right.
It's their idea. They're the ones who are going to work at that job forever. Well, not forever. That sounds awful. But, you know, it's their world. And so you're there to assist it and make it better and to help them grow. And so for me, yeah, it's about being very kind and acknowledging their contributions in a really strong way.
Okay.
That's one way.
Yeah.
Yeah, how about you?
We struggle with that sometimes. I think, you know, it's just like asking lots of questions and kind of what you were saying, like making sure, going out of your way to give them credit for ideas, because you really do want buy-in. You really want people to feel like, like we're solving this problem that you have together. And you are probably going to say this, but here's my idea. You know, like, or you are probably going to get there anyway. This is just.
Yeah. Just and not in a pandering way. It's like, believe it, because, you know, they're the ones who are living and breathing that subject matter every single day.
It can definitely be a struggle.
It can be. But I guess that's the skill is figuring out how to really utilize them as a resource, which is usually how I try to think about clients, as a really great subject matter resource. And also you know, the people who have to take care of it for the rest of its life, whatever it is.
Right.
I guess that's a big incentive to do a good job on keeping them on board.
Yeah.
Right? Because you don't want to see it. You don't want to log on 6 months later and cry.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Sometimes, because they have an immense amount, usually, of like domain knowledge. The stuff that they're coming to the table with, whether it's they're running a restaurant or they're running this crazy online service or something, and it's like, I mean, you know, I feel like there's a lot of compromise involved to find a place where they're comfortable. You know, like I'm, you know, when I approach something, I'm always like, I have these great ideas for how far we could push this. And, you know, you kind of have to split the difference or something. And like, you know, like, well, how can we still bring you the benefits that I'm excited about without scaring away people who are in your like demographic or something?
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is hard.
I'm a designer, and maybe designers famously tend towards thinking that they're artists sometimes. I don't know.
Well, you do. There is some artistry in there, right?
A little bit,
yeah.
So how would you, let's take a step back, how would you define information architecture?
Well, I mean, it's a piece, it's a tool you have in your kit to do good design work, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's just about how you represent content and ideas that you're trying to express. So it's the structure of that representation.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, you know, you might put something in... say you've got a page and you've got three equal columns and you put information in those three equal columns with the same three headers, styles, and there they are in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
If really one of those is actually a subcontent to one of the other ones, but you're placing it on the same exact level as the other two, then it immediately starts to confuse somebody and they're not sure why, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So those are just like subtle little things. In terms of digital design.
That's a good example, yeah.
So then they dive that next step down and they start to, it just starts to collapse from there and it's really subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Are there, talking about the, where you're at right now, you finished this accelerator program. What is it that you're going to be doing now, for instance?
I'm working with two companies right now.
Okay.
One is a micropayment or a mobile payment solution that will be launching a pilot in Mexico soon. So that one's been really interesting. So we're working on that with another agency in town. And then another product I'm working on is called CoPatient. And you essentially send them your medical bills and they identify the errors and help you reduce them. And they've found that 80% of the bills they see have savings of 30 to 80%. So
cool.
It's quite interesting space to be in.
Yeah.
And so I'm working on the front end consumer product and trying to figure out how to make this like, you know, in my mind, if a service like this exists, it should just be like due diligence for your family. Like you don't have to do it, but if you do, then you're saving some money for your family and that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to figure out how to sort of wrap a really fun consumer experience or easy,
mm-hmm.
Habitual experience and, you know,
mm-hmm.
to create that. But then there's also this really fun piece on the back end, which is supporting the people who are actually finding the errors and doing the work and helping figure out really interesting input methods for them to share their knowledge with the rest of the people so that can become more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working on sort of developing different mechanisms to get that stuff out of their head and into a system.
Mm-hmm.
Along with, you know, matching that up with the technology in terms of pattern recognition and really smart databases.
Okay.
So
how do you just like know? I mean, how do you find projects like this? You just know a lot of people, or is it? I'm just curious.
Oh yeah, Portland's just been a really wonderful place to be.
Mm-hmm.
I got laid off right at the beginning of the down economy, mm-hmm. right after I moved here,
mm-hmm.
and so I just went right. So I just went freelance, and you go to lots of happy hours and lots of events, and you meet everybody.
So like Think and Drink kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm an original Think and Drink member, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Do you go?
No, I've been meaning to for, like, ever.
Yeah.
I
that was kind of a cool, special thing. And actually, I was thinking the other day, and there are about five people who, when that started, did not call themselves UX people, but are now practicing UX people. So I kind of feel proud.
Yeah, there you go.
I was just thinking about that the other day. I was like, oh, that's so cool.
So it sounds like the type of stuff that you're doing would touch a lot on what people call gamification.
Hmm.
Is that a valid?
Interesting.
Is that a valid concept?
I guess that sort of concept is infusing everything we do these days, isn't it?
I think so.
And maybe I guess my role would be to figure out what those those mm-hmm. game triggers are.
Yeah.
Interesting. I haven't thought of it that way.
Well, I don't know if that's the right term. I mean, sometimes I feel like that term is mm-hmm. just, there's probably a proper psychological name for it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just when it's sort of...
the mechanism that hooks people, the mechanism that allows it to continue and grow, and
mm-hmm.
that design process, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I don't know that... there's a name for the thing where it's like you, like intermittent reward that sort of hooks you to something
mm-hmm.
that online services try to successfully do a lot. I don't know if it's, you know, say like with Twitter, like periodically getting retweeted, or maybe it's with Facebook getting, you know, like
something
a lot of times
related to like a feedback loop of
yeah,
some sort.
Yeah, where it's like if you get a consistent reward, you get bored.
Yeah.
But if you get, you don't know when the reward's coming and it comes, hopefully some listener will call in.
Oh, yeah.
We're not live, but at some point I'll figure out what the name for that is, and I'll put it
I should know. I've just sat down there and listened to a lot of speakers talk about gamification and those pieces, but...
like, maybe that's, yeah.
I'm really bad with remembering proper names and mm-hmm. some vocabulary terms. But I got it in my head, yeah. I think that's an interesting way to look at it. Because I'm not a visual designer, so I'm not the one to take it to the place where the subtleties of expressing those methods, but more at the beginning, where we sort of conceive of what they might be and how they might live and grow over time.
So I'm going to bring up a topical subject here.
Yes.
There was an event yesterday that Apple did. Did you see any of the stuff, the work that was done for iOS 7 or any of that? Have you watched that?
I didn't, because I was at our demo day. And
oh, right.
I took a couple glances at this morning on Twitter, but didn't have time to dig in. What do you think?
Oh,
I saw a blog or somebody put a Tumblr together about all the designers complaining.
Yeah,
complaining
I saw that.
Tweets.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was funny. I think probably when I look at it from a design perspective, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm more curious. I feel like it might be, especially at first, people might be really confused. Mm-hmm. The user experience might... I mean, and my whole take on it is that the original design of all this stuff was... it used, I don't know the term skeuomorphic... you know, kind of where you look at something and it's like it looks like the thing it's supposed to represent.
Oh, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
And it went even beyond that with the old iOS, where it was like you'd see something and it would have a felt thing or like stitching. And it was
yucky.
Much, much maligned, we'll
yes.
say, on social media and elsewhere. And the new version of all of this just dispatches with all of that. It's all completely gone. Because maybe people don't need that mental crutch. I mean, when the iPhone originally came out, there was no reference point. There was no full, nothing, you know, no phones with no buttons. And now maybe people don't need that, but I feel like it's great, but a lot of people are going to be confused. There's going to be a lot of tech support.
Mm.
I feel like from a user experience point, it might be difficult for Apple.
I'm tired of making everything easy for everybody. I feel like at some point people need to be expected to learn something. I don't know how far I'll back that up, but that's definitely sort of my gut feeling at this stage in the game, just that we've kind of trained everyone to expect that if you can't learn something in 2 seconds, that it's not worth learning when it comes to the digital, which I think is holding us back in a lot of ways. Now, I will also say that I'm also, you know, highly passionate about thinking about the inequity that exists when people have to use tools that don't work well, and it puts them at a disadvantage. And so there's somewhere in the middle of that, there's got to be some answer. Although I would say using an iPhone is not any sort of human right, so go ahead and take a moment to learn it. Well, this whole conversation came up too when when the latest Windows came out, right? Have you played with that at all?
Yes.
What do you think about it? Is it the same feeling you're feeling about the new
iOS?
It
might well be. Yeah, it might well be. I think that, famously someone posted that video where it was like he was sat his dad down to use it and the poor man couldn't launch an app or anything. I mean, because people, they're really hooked on the fact that there's that start button and there's just the familiar elements that they, I don't know. I don't feel like it's quite to that degree with an iPhone, because you still swipe your finger to the left and you still see the same grid of icons. You're not going to have that problem. It's nowhere near the problem that Windows created with Windows 8. But at the same time, I feel like I assume when I played with it, I played with one that was already installed, as did that gentleman. But I assume the first time you run it, there's some sort of intro or something. Not that that's an excuse for being difficult to use, but I assume there's something like the start menu's not here, you do this instead or something.
Yeah, right. Maybe we just need to get a lot better at training people how to use things.
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people will disagree when they hear this. They'll be like, blasphemy. We're trying to get a zero training. I don't know though.
I think
knowledge is gained through work and time, I guess.
It's hard for me because I'm so old that when I was young, if you didn't read a book, you could not use a computer.
Yeah.
Get out of town. There was no such thing. I mean, even playing music was something you probably read a manual to do, to operate a stereo. But, I mean...
Yeah, I guess I'm not saying you need a manual for your iPhone. But, you could take a moment, watch a video or something.
Yeah.
I'd like more customization and more awesome tools with something that I carry around with me all day. I mean, I'm constantly frustrated by my iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things that waste my time, when it should, when it takes like 5 taps to get someplace that I go regularly, shouldn't I just
put like
a shortcut?
What's an example?
Well, this isn't the phone's fault, but some Bluetooth devices are just kind of lame. And you know how long it takes to access your Bluetooth, to select it, where you have to force connect them?
I'm so tempted to just show you because I installed the beta.
You're in your car.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're going through 6 taps unsafely while driving down the road. Just so I can listen to my podcast. I was like crazy.
It's funny. I installed it because I'm a risk taker. And they did solve a lot of problems. But because it's in beta, there's some real obvious problems that have come up. And one of which was I was using it for directions to go to a meeting today. And it popped up some alert asking for a Wi-Fi password, and then the whole thing just crashed. I couldn't get... I was lost. It wouldn't give me directions. I was this needs a little bit of work, but...
Bummer.
Yeah, enough about that. what do you do besides what you do for work to get, inspiration or inform you or make you a more well-rounded person?
Let's see. I do love listening to radio and podcasts, and so it was kind of fun to be here because my dream is to be interviewed by like some of the greats because it would be so cool, like Kurt Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
I love him. So, you know, I don't... So I love to listen to stories. I love to hear how people craft things together. I love to hear little tidbits about new stuff I've not heard of. I love to hear people talk about their art and why and how they do it. So I that's a big part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot of sitting around and chatting and talking with people, exploring ideas, saying, you know, the most ridiculous thing and seeing how it sounds out loud, right?
So all right.
Conversation. You're from Minnesota, right?
That's right.
I heard that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have the best conversation in Minnesota. Like, there's just this, I call it intellectual asshole.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this banter you just don't get around here. I don't know mm-hmm. if it's from being cooped up most of the year inside that you just become a good conversationalist.
That is but a great theory. That might be
true. No, it's like something so wonderful about it. It's so funny. And maybe it's just because everybody went to, like, liberal arts school and, like, I don't know what
it's
it is.
It's so funny that you say that when my wife and I and our kids went to Minneapolis recently and we get to our hotel and, like, I think three people started a conversation with us before. Like, we were in an elevator and, like, you're accustomed to people being quiet.
Yes.
Instead, like, the person, like, starts a conversation with Candace and she's, like, looking at me nervously. I'm like, oh, this is your... In the Midwest, everyone will start a conversation with you here.
And totally explain things. Like, around here, I feel like people will just assume that you don't want to hear it, or, like, that you might already know it, or that, you know, I do this. Like, maybe I'm not the one to talk on the subject. Uh-huh. So, I don't know. There's something funny about that. Anyway, so whenever I can find a good conversation, that's, to me, I think, the most inspiring thing for my work, listening to other people and...
Uh-huh.
Seeing where they're coming from, seeing how they're formulating things, right? Because my whole job is about anticipating how people's brains are going to work. Right. And the best way to do that is chatting with people.
Right.
So.
Do you have any, is there a TV show you're in love with right now?
I'm one of those people who's like behind by like two seasons and watch it on Netflix. So.
Yeah.
I guess
no, that's totally valid.
Is that valid now?
Yeah, I don't actually get TV other than Netflix. So.
No, me either. So I just do all the regulars, you know. I love Friday Night Lights. I just watched that again.
Okay.
So that was fun. And then everything else might, you know, you could probably tell by looking at me that I would watch. Although I don't like much violence, so I kind of like, I got down the realm, or I got kind of far. On the meth show. What is it? Breaking Bad.
Oh, Breaking Bad, yeah.
And then it just started getting too yucky, so I had to stop.
I can't watch any of those shows.
And I didn't watch Dexter or anything. I just can't do it.
Right.
I'm too sensitive. That stuff just haunts me forever.
Me too. I got like halfway through the first episode of Dexter, and I was like, oh.
No.
Terrible.
Why?
Yeah.
So, give me Friday Night Lights.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just a sucker for like dumb comedies. Cool. Do you have any advice you'd like to leave folks with who are interested in doing the type of stuff that you're doing?
Yeah. Well, somehow I feel I didn't really explain what I do very well, so that's unfortunate. But I think that's kind of... I think all of us who do what I do have that fault.
On that subject, I'm not sure. It seems like you do a little of everything, kind of around like really exciting new venture type stuff. That's about the best I would be able to explain it to someone from my view.
That's right. I know. So I help figure out exactly what the business should be and how to make it, how to design a product that's going to make it a super successful business. And then, I do everything to the wonderful wireframing process and collaborating with visual designers to conceive like wonderful interactions, both small and big, and all of those wonderful UX things. But I guess for me personally, like the front, the beginning processes, the workshopping and brainstorming and organizing all of the little bits of information to kind of define what's going to happen is really what I do.
Okay.
And I guess advice for people is, I think, you know, if you have a natural talent for this type of stuff, if you're always trying to make things make sense, if you're always sort of identifying how something might be a little bit more graceful, or feeling like products are ignoring actual human need and human behavior, and you're often trying to solve that, then sort of following that gut instinct, this might be a job for you. And in that case, then start putting the work in. If you're a visual designer and you want to start to get into this world of work, and then start documenting how you inform your design, you know. Come up with different visualizations to visualize the process you took to get there, rather than just doing it in your head and then getting it down on paper, you know, and then just doing the design. Because going through those exercises will help you start to explore new questions you should be asking yourself, new research paths that you might want to open up to have a more informed design. Because I think that's probably, you know, my contribution in to the project. Of course, lots of projects go forward without my type of position and role, and lots of visual designers are amazing at doing, you know, a lot of this type of stuff themselves. But the UX designer brings an informedness by spending a lot of time really digging deeply into certain pieces and to finding out the answers. So I guess as a visual designer or a developer, if you're trying to make that transition, it would be to start to spend a little bit more time there and challenge yourself to figure out new and interesting ways to define projects before you actually start building them.
Okay.
I know. Yeah. Or find someone to shadow and work with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Taisha, can we expect anything exciting from you personally in the future? Are you working on some top secret projects you want to reveal here?
Well, you know,
someday someone's going to have some amazing thing like, oh my gosh, well, actually, I'm curing cancer, but...
Right, I want to. The Gates Foundation keeps putting out these wonderful grant proposals for really wonderful ideas that they want to throw tons of money at. So I keep looking at them and starting to jot down ideas and stuff, but nothing has stuck yet. But I've got a lot of ideas. You know, I just recently, like I think the last thing I wrote on my blog was about this idea of that having a desk job is rules. And how we need to sort of shift the attitude about a desk job so that people who are coming into the workforce, who are in high school, who are transitioning careers, actually see these as viable positions for themselves. Because amongst a lot of different either subcultures or a class of people or just... personal experience, the idea of a desk job is like not that great. And so people are kind of immediately counting, you know, that out when really that's where the new economy is taking us. And we need to sort of put a better picture and really show how wonderful it can be. I mean, because I have a desk job and it is amazing.
Yeah.
So this is kind of one of my new projects, which I've got to get some energy behind, but I kind of want to start highlighting, you know, people doing amazing desk jobs and kind of shift that. And I just think back to high school, and it's like it's almost like a dirty word. Like people want to do more exciting things. Do you sense?
No. Like, no? What would you rather do than? I mean, that seems like all the interesting stuff happens at desk.
And that's maybe
at a standing desk, maybe as an alternative.
I don't know. I just look at growing up. I always heard a lot of this, and I still hear today. And I think there's a segment of society that like doesn't quite understand what happens up in those big tall office buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for them to ever have access to the middle class and to participating in the new economy, that needs to be an available option to people.
Interesting.
And I think that this perspective about the desk job is one of those perpetuating issues.
Yeah,
anyway, it's just a theory. So I started looking at, I'm just kind of looking into that and thinking about It could be cool. It could be neat to maybe go in and talk to high school students and show them sort of like, you know, what are all those people doing in those big high rises, and what right. could be really interesting or those little offices. So I don't know.
I guess I see what you're saying. I mean, I think that my view of you just see some random massive office building and you just assume everyone in there is still sitting there with punch cards or those like
Absolutely.
Visors on or something, you know, like sharpening their pencil in a little pencil sharpener. It's like,
yeah, and that there's no creativity
in this,
there.
The economy has changed so much that that's not what, there's probably no one in that building with a visor on and a pencil, you know, like they're all like, there's just that type of part of the workforce doesn't, you don't need massive numbers of people to sit there and work with spreadsheets. It's more like that stuff's being automated so much that most of those jobs are becoming creative jobs.
Exactly.
I feel like this is the best time in history to be a designer. It's like the new booming.
Absolutely.
You know.
But I would say it took me until a number of years after college before I even realized designer was a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't even that long ago. And I even went to college. So, I mean, it's just...
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's just kind of interesting to think about. And so I'm just kind of wondering if there's some way to contribute in a creative, designerly fashion in sort of like some sort of campaign type of a thing to sort of level the playing field just right out of the gate for people's minds to shift and think, you know what? I can't wait to get my desk job. I want to punch the clock at my desk. You know, like, because that's where all the awesome stuff happens.
This, as part of the, like, this keynote is fresh in my mind, all this stuff that Apple put out.
Yeah.
And they had this thing where they showed this, like, inspirational video, and it was, like, what they were selling was really not a product or anything. It was just, it was, like, the phrase made by Apple in California. Well, you need to make one that's, like, made by a person at desk.
Right? Exactly. There's some fun stuff. I don't know. I just think it'd be interesting if people talk about their stories. And then, and then just, like, additionally on that point, I remember being in the workplace when I first got out of college and seeing this really big discrepancy between male and female performance with the entry-level folks, and also the lack of men at the entry-level jobs in the offices.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that had to do with when because I also was reviewing resumes in that job, guys would get these construction jobs and these other sorts of jobs that paid good money, like in high school and right out of college, because... Mm-hmm. And then the girls would go and get, like, these low-paying administrative jobs where they actually started to build skills, whereas the men would come out of college and would just have this resume that had, like, all these high-paying labor jobs on it, but no office skills whatsoever.
Right.
Which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. But and I know that we definitely haven't – it hasn't shifted to the point where women are way more successful in the workplace than men, but it's kind of an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, it's true.
It starts right there, just like the skill levels and
I mean, it's an extreme example, but a relative of mine had a son, and he was like really frustrated because he was like, you know, I was off trying to do all these entrepreneurial things, and his son like wouldn't. He was like, well, I'll give you this money to start a business. He's like, yeah, but he literally got a job hauling trash because it paid so much more quickly.
Absolutely.
And I was like, you are insane. I took him aside. I was like, are you crazy? This guy's offering you seed money to start a business doing like anything. There's so many possibilities.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know that I could never relate to that kid.
Yeah. So there's something in there. And I mean, I'm just touching the iceberg of what I think the problem is. And to tell you the truth, I haven't really, it's totally anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's something about like crafting the story about how amazing the new economy is and how to get into it, what the opportunities are, so that it starts to appeal on all levels and also just kind of celebrates this kind of interesting time we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. We'll see.
Well, you know, the world needs ditch diggers too. No, I'm kidding.
cool.
Well, thank you, Taisha. Where should people find you online to learn more about what you do?
I am the OG Taisha on pretty much every social network. So
okay.
The early adopter Taisha, except on Twitter. Well, I do have Taisha at at Taisha, but I'm Taisha Snow on Twitter and TaishaSnow.com. And Taisha on Instagram if you want to look at my super cute baby.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming down.
Yeah, awesome.
As I mentioned to you earlier, I installed the beta on my phone, and now I can listen to iRadio, and it's nice, it sounds good, and I think that the stations it puts together are pretty darn nice. So I put together a Chuck Berry station, pursuant to our discussion last week. And
compliance of?
Yeah. you know, I'll be honest, I like Chuck Berry less than most of the other artists on there.
Really?
Well, you know, it's interesting listening to 50s rock because it's just so poorly recorded. You know, like, it's just, it's all very much like you're lucky if you can really make out anything past the snare and the vocal. You know, just that backbeat. You know, like, that's it. You get that in the vocal. And if there's a pause in the vocal line, they'll fill it in with a guitar. But if both are going on at the same time, you couldn't even make it out, you know? Like, that's where they're at.
Is it just muddy? Or, like, a...
I feel like they're...
Or just dropped out completely?
Yeah, no, it would be really muddy. I feel like they're... They weren't... I mean, like, their recording sessions back then were just, like, throw a mic up and see what you can get in an hour. You know? It's just, and like equalization
in a room behind the radio station.
Yeah,
in
some
small town.
Exactly. Like, equalization was just not heard of. So, like, especially in the Chuck Berry, the guitars are so mid-rangey that they're right there with the vocals. So you couldn't have both going at the same time, or you wouldn't be able to make out the words. You know. And obviously, there's no stereo.
And people like to sing along more than they like to play air guitar.
Right.
So you're going to hear the lyrics first.
Although what was interesting is on that station, some like an instrumental of Chuck Berry's came up. And I'm just going to sound like such a dick, but man, he was not a good guitarist.
Really?
He was like...
See, I don't think I could make that judgment.
Maybe it was just an off day. But I was like, he was making, like, really amateurish mistakes. Like, he's fretting a chord incompletely. Like, strumming a chord and, like... And it was like he was falling asleep while he was doing it. His heart wasn't into, like, you know, the frets. It was frustrating. It was like, I don't get it. Like, and then, like, it was kind of like how... It was probably what I was hearing was a session where someone was like, well, we've got 10 minutes left. Let's play anything and just record a B-side. You know, so he probably hadn't even, like, written the song. It was like he was literally making it up as he went, you know. So I'm being really
harsh. And exhausted.
Yeah, and exhausted, and, like, he probably had a gig in a half hour.
Well, I don't know. I feel similarly. It was weird. Like, weird analogy, perhaps, but... I spent a lot of time studying English literature, specifically 19th century English literature.
Okay.
I feel toward Chuck Berry as I do toward Byron.
Okay.
Like,
wow.
For some reason that happened. Like, clearly hugely influential, clearly, like, laying groundwork for things that would come later.
Yeah.
Don't care for it much.
Right.
Like, and I feel like maybe I'm incapable of divorcing myself from the... everything that's come in between, like all of the things that were influenced by him. That's what I'm hearing, and I'm hearing, like, the improvements that if so to speak that were made off of that or something. But yeah, I was like, all right, let's get to the end now.
Yeah,
like, I think I heard this one 10 tracks ago.
Yeah.
And yeah, 5 tracks ago.
Yeah, it's very one-dimensional to me. And, you know, but what was striking me as I was listening to that mix is, like, in the write-up in this book, 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, they mention John Lennon several times.
Sure.
But the person in the mix who I thought of as being the most influential on John Lennon was not Chuck Berry. I think maybe he thought it was cool to say that, but really it was... how could I be blanking his name? You know, that'll be the day.
Buddy Holly.
Yeah, Buddy Holly was in that mix too a lot. Mm. And like Buddy Holly, like I know that John Lennon idolized Buddy Holly. Like, I mean, even in the fact that he wore glasses and Lennon wore glasses and
they're
was ashamed
a good
of it.
Glasses style.
They are, yes, they are. But, you know, like, even in the way that, like, Lennon often tried to do stuff to his vocals, and Buddy Holly was the first person to really use that sort of slapback echo, like, on the 16th note, where it's just like, you know, like, there was a kind of that. And then the other person, so I would say definitely Buddy Holly, but then as also in that mix was Elvis, who, and probably through less... It was less Elvis, more probably the Colonel or his producers or something. But like Elvis's recordings from that same period or probably soon after, because he stole all of those ideas and put them together. Like he was literally just covering these songs that you just heard 2 years earlier. But they sound so much better. Like the sound of them is like the guitarist well rehearsed, like... The way he sang was really, he really understood how to work the mic. Like, he really knew how to sing. You know, obviously it's Elvis. I mean,
was that a function of being in Sun Studios, though? Like, because that was like...
Everything came together. I mean, those recordings sound so good after you hear
some... all of those are like, even like Jerry Lee Lewis and...
Well, see, Jerry Lee Lewis was in that mix too, and...
I feel like some of his early stuff, it just sounds better than
it
like...
It does. It sounds very lively.
Early Johnny Cash stuff sounds really good.
I can't picture what the Sun Studio looked like, but yeah, that is where all those were recorded.
Have you not been there?
No.
The museum?
No.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really, really...
Huh.
Like, the studio is there. And uh-huh. You can, like, it's behind glass. Like, you're not allowed in it, but
right.
You can look at it.
Where is that at?
In Memphis.
Okay. Well, no, I've never been to
Memphis. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Okay. I need to go there then.
And,
interesting.
You know, down the street from Graceland.
See, I was just reading a book on Abbey Road, the studio... And boy, different world there. You know, like that was like a studio run by scientists who recorded like orchestras. And like, it was funny. You see the rooms that the Beatles went in like to record, it was like they had to like just like pile shit around them to make it sound like a small room, like probably Sun Studio was, you know, like that's the thing I was wondering about.
It's pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Abbey Road, like, it's like, are you in the Studio A or Studio B? Either one is like a football stadium, and so really? Like they're just really big. They're you know, not I'm exaggerating, but they're very big rooms. So they would actually like try to find the smallest studio in Abbey Road, which is still probably bigger than Sun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Elvis is the most orally ear, not orally mouth, enjoyable to listen to. it's always awkward.
Yeah.
But they're pronounced the same.
A-U-R-ly.
If it was in writing, you wouldn't think it weird. Anyway, so that was, yeah. No, I'm not as familiar with... I'm impressed with your analogy there, but I'm not familiar with 19th century.
No, it was not meant to be impressive. It was meant to... for some reason, that's just how things... A lot of things just come back to 20th century poetry. especially the influential things
yeah.
that I meant to like... Like, you know, you should respect this. And, like, it's almost like you're inheriting this, like, grandiosity of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you just don't like it mm-hmm. much.
Yeah.
But you recognize that.
Yeah. You can listen to it either... Sometimes you listen to it with, like, that level of respect. Like, okay, you're taking it in context, in historical context, and it's very meaningful, and it's mm-hmm. impressive, and it... When you listen to it, you can hear what the Beatles took from it and everybody after that. But then really, you also just listen to it for whether or not you enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, then, you know. Frankly, I enjoyed, like, I was really enjoying Little Richard in that mix. Like, Little Richard was fucking awesome. I could barely imagine if I was, like, at, like, you know, 15 when, like, I first heard a Little Richard record in, like, the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I would have shit my pants. Like, yeah. Holy shit, this is, like, the most exciting thing that's ever been recorded. Like, the guy's just like, screaming. And if he stops to take a breath, this, like, saxophone basically takes over screaming for him. It's just ridiculous. It's so good.
Yes, I agree completely. I love Little Richard for that reason.
He's hilarious.
there are those tours that they did, like those like big like package deal tours mm-hmm. through the South mostly, mm-hmm. where I'm sure like difficult tours, like early 60s, mm-hmm. kind of late 50s, early 60s, where they were just like pile all these bands on a bus and like tour through the South. It must have been amazing.
Yeah.
And they were playing mostly to white audiences.
Yeah.
Which was one of the reasons they had that bus ready to go.
Yeah.
All the time.
And like the audience would be like segregated or?
No. No. And that was.
Interesting.
That was one of the big.
Huh.
Like, one of the big sticking points.
Yeah.
So they'd get, you know, the adults in the town would not be very happy about it, but like the kids all loved them, you mm-hmm. know? So like, and this led to, you know, the rock and roll is going to destroy our children.
Sure.
This was the beginning, but man, there's so many of those early like rock and roll acts were just, they were just torn the house down. Like,
yeah. I mean, listening like, to that, just those different, events. Yeah, it was like love them or hate them. Like, it's funny because all those people who are in that mix I was listening to on iRadio,
mm-hmm.
there was probably at least one occasion when they all played a show together. You know, it's entirely possible. Right. Like, holy shit, that's like the mother of all, like, you know, or like how when like, you know, the Beatles used to tour England, a lot of times it was that same thing. They would do the same thing over there. It was like the Beatles, and then there was also like, you know, like maybe Ray Charles would be touring with them, or you know, who's that? And like Roy Orbison would mm. tour with them, and that very soulful woman's like I want to say Buffalo Springfield, but it's a woman's name and it's
Dusty.
Not, yeah, thank you. That's so bad. It's like, you just gave me like name a bunch of names that. It just becomes like a stand-up routine. I cannot remember anyone's anything.
I like picturing like Dusty Springfield made of Buffalo Springfield, like Neil Young just as like one eye and Stephen Stills as another. It's like Gollum of Canadian hippies to bring it all back around.
Oh boy. All right. Well, that's a rough spot.
Yeah, that might get edited.
Maybe it probably won't. I think it's your turn to pick out next week's listening.
All right.
He's shaking the book.
Here we go.
Don't fail me now, lucky finger.
Oh, wait. Nope. That was.
Oh, okay.
We already opened to that
oh,
one.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Huh? Well, I guess there's two albums on this page. Do you want to go left or right?
If there's two, then you just get to pick which one you want.
Well, then definitely we're going with CCR.
Okay.
Willie and the Poor Boys.
Okay. The album. Okay, nice. We have that record here.
It's like subtitled The Dirty South.
Oh, I didn't know that. The album is something?
No, the article, entry in the book.
Little essay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's going to be easy. That was not their... That was a later album of theirs, wasn't it?
69.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, like third or fourth, yeah. Maybe?
But Fortunate Son, Midnight Special, Down on the Corner. Like, so...
Yeah.
Big singles for them.
Midnight Special is loathsome. I'm going to have trouble with that
loathsome.
One. But, you know, Willie and the Poor Boys is a sing-along. Everyone loves that.
What is the... I'm blanking, but it doesn't matter. We can move on.
Well, no. This is where we end. Let's see. I got to write this down. Willie and the Poor... Willie and the Poor Boys by CCR, we'll just say.
Credence.
Do you think they're more often, when they were around, do you think they were called Credence or CCR? Because I call them CCR, but I'm like a nerd. I acronym
it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I
will say IMHO to people.
IMHO. That's true. You are the first person I've ever known to say that out loud. And I like that.
Yeah.
I think the first time I heard you say that, I was eating lunch and nearly choked laughing.
It's funny. That's like someone... what was that? There's like a... I was at a family gathering and an older relative asked me what FTW meant. Sometimes it's so hard to explain those because I was like, well, it means for the win. It's like, well...
That requires
what does that mean? Like, what's for the win? It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the first time you explain what the little, you know, semicolon right parenthesis is, you know, it's like, well, it's a smiley, but you got to be real creative with your head position. My allergies are killing me.
I had that all weekend. Oh, I'm feeling better now.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad it wasn't just me. I thought I was going crazy, but it's like we decided to drive out to Silver Falls, the source of all suffering and pain in allergy land.
Sure.
And like I step out of the car and it just hit me like a big, I don't know, hive. It was just like instantly I just started like sneezing uncontrollably. Like my nose was running. My nose running so bad that like it would run like water. Like I couldn't catch it quick enough with a Kleenex. My wife would be talking to me and she'd like start retching. Like, what are you doing? Your nose is just running.
You're grabbing your kids and just wiping it on them. Because they're dirty anyway. They're sticky. You can just...
Oh, it was terrible. And I was just so miserable. It's like, and your eyes itch and you can't see and you're like walking down this cliff next to a waterfall and you might die, you don't know. It just was so, and then like it, I was telling Elizabeth, we on the way back we decided to stop at a grocery store mainly because I could get some Benadryl, which I just dry swallowed right in the store. Just like there was an employee right there, I just ripped it open and like dry swallowed a couple of Benadryl.
He was like, I understand, man, you'll be okay.
Well, yeah. Nothing was said, just meaningful glances were exchanged. And then I got home, and this is like right before Father's Day, and I just like realized that Benadryl, oh, it's the same ingredient that is like in Tylenol PM that makes you sleepy. And I got home and I was just like, this is weird. I'm like super tired. I don't know why. Let me read the rest of that packaging.
Benadryl makes me slip into a light coma within like a half an hour.
Like, yeah, like seriously.
Asleep where I'm standing, kind of like.
It was like.
Better be done.
It was a good thing we got home because I was driving. Yeah. Jeez. Although it did, I could at least get one nostril functioning, which helps a lot when you have to, like, I don't know, eat or drink or anything. I took some DayQuil before this, but I don't know where we're going here. I'm just.
I'm operating under the assumption that all of this is getting killed.
I'm totally leaving this in. In fact, I woke up at some point last night and I went to get water. And it's like...
Raise mucus.
It's like you forget that your nose is stuffy and you start drinking the water and then you just stop and just spit it out because you realize, oh, I can't breathe through my nose if I need to. I just panicked. So I'm just spitting all over the kitchen in the dark. I don't know, I think I need to see a doctor. Yeah, so that was my weekend.
Rather than swallow.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it'd be safer to spit. Just uncomplicated. Just get it out. Rethink the whole process here.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing at your misfortune.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
But it's funny.
Yeah. So I experimented with medication. I did find that Benadryl helps, but really only in the evenings. I can't take it in the day.
So what are you operating with now?
DayQuil.
All right. Doing anything for you?
I can breathe through one nostril.
There you go.
You know, that's enough.
You just need to, like, get some cayenne.
I don't know. You know, no, what I need to do is I need to do something like that where I'm putting strange, but natural, saline fluids in there.
As bizarre as neti pots are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big proponent of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're useful.
I knew you were going to say proponent.
Yeah.
I'm a big proponent. I'm such a proponent that I've proponented past that into the mechanized machines where you put the tube in your nose and you turn it on and a little motor runs.
Oh,
and it powers it in there. It just seems really dangerous because if your nose is stuffed up, it's like, where else is it going to go? Your brain. I don't... at some point, I get nervous and I take it out. Like, I don't want to push it.
Someone gave us, when my daughter was an infant, like a tube to like suck rather than the ball.
Yeah, yeah. The snot sucker.
Yeah.
We have one
of
those.
The tube with the one-way valve.
Yeah.
Those are great.
For your child, you mean?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I suppose you could use it on yourself.
But you, maybe, you know, get one up in one. And
yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no. I that the honor there goes straight to Kansas, but she does it willingly. Awkward look.
That was the you will edit that out.
Willingly. Well, she does it. Yeah. It's right up there with clipping the cat's nails.
Oh, that's a job. So Creedence was a band that existed.
Yeah, yeah.
They probably had allergies.
Yeah.
A lot of flannel.
Yeah, that's a weird story, that band. They now tour as Creedence Clearwater Revisited.
Really?
Which is a subtly disguised name for the band that doesn't have the person who sings the songs in it. They play casinos.
The one without John Fogerty?
Yeah, like Fogerty tours as John fucking Fogerty, dude.
Yeah.
But the rest of the band tours as Creedence Clearwater Revisited.
Does he own the songs now? Wasn't it? Over and over again.
Like the person who owned Fantasy, I think, was the label that they were on. Like, had some like blood feud with John Fogerty.
Oh, he had that great thing where he got taken to court for like sampling himself,
and with, lost, I think.
Yeah, like Put Me in Coach had like a riff that was in a CCR song. And he got sued for it.
Oh, yeah. It had a riff for, like, Fortunate Son in
maybe.
It, didn't it?
Yeah.
And
he didn't own it, so they sued him.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to use your own work.
I think what happened, though, is that the guy who owned Fantasy or whatever, he finally passed away, and his son immediately contacted John Fogerty and made it right. It was just like, okay, let's make this right. And then I think John Fogerty like put out a new album on that label, so I think everything's cool. Fine now, but yeah. This is all stuff that I think I might have heard at some point. I should probably look that up. Maybe for next week.
I'm remembering this from like a VH1 Behind the Music
in the 90s.
I think.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Which reminds me, I still haven't finished watching that Black Sabbath one that I was watching.
Did you ever finish the Columbia book?
No.
Okay.
I didn't. I'm still in the 60s. I'm just reveling.
A lot was happening.
Yeah. That's good, though. That's good. That's a good iBook. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Put Me in Coach. Is that what he was singing?